Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. In a little over 24 hours, Pope Francis will touch down on U.S. soil for the first time. Papal visits have always been a big deal, of course, but the energy, compassion, and optimism of this pope in particular have won him fans even outside the Catholic Church. On the eve of the pope's arrival, we wanted to know about the climate inside the Catholic Church. One in five Americans identifies as Catholic, but how much can that label tell us about the values, actions, spiritual, and political lives of those who worship in Catholic churches? Charles Curran is Elizabeth Scurlock University Professor of Human Values at SMU. Matthew Wilson is Associate Professor of Political Science in the Dedman College of Humanities and Sciences at SMU. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Is it fair to say that American Catholics are more excited about this visit by Pope Francis than they were by Pope Benedict's visit in 2008?
I think there is more enthusiasm, more of an aura of real excitement and euphoria about this visit. The one I would compare it to was when Pope John Paul II visited the United States in the 1980s. There was this kind of palpable energy and excitement surrounding that visit that I think is similar to what we're seeing with Pope Francis now.
I think that makes sense. I thought the first visit was in 79 from John Paul II. And, I mean, that was the first big visit. It was Boston. I mean, he was a very young and athletic-type person. And I think throughout the country there was a real palpable feeling about the Pope's coming. So it's about the same as now, I think.
Historically, it would seem that the Catholic Church has really been centered in the United States, in the Northeast, in the Midwest, and now that's starting to shift to the West and the Southwest part of the country, in part because so many Catholics are relatively recent immigrants.
Oh, there's no doubt that, I mean, certainly within 50 years, the majority of Catholics will probably be Hispanic in this country, and that is obviously going to change the face of the Church very much. And unfortunately, up to the present, I don't think the Church has been aware enough of that. The number of Hispanic bishops in the country isn't all that great. I think one has to realize there's a real change coming.
And we see that on a day-to-day basis when you go to churches here in the North Texas area. I mean, they're bursting at the seams, standing room only. The Church here in North Texas can't build sanctuaries fast enough and schools fast enough to accommodate the growing Catholic population. And that's really in contrast to what you see in Chicago or Boston or some of these traditional centers of American Catholicism where a lot of churches have dwindling congregations and things like that. And so that really does show the demographic shift within American Catholicism.
Another interesting demographic shift is that Catholics are getting older by the year. In 2007, the median age of a Catholic adult in this country was 45. Today it's 49. That's a pretty quick shift upward.
I'm not into that area of academics, but it seems to me the whole country's getting a little older. At least the Anglo-Saxon population of the country is probably about the same, I would assume.
So it's basically just reflecting what's happening.
I would think so. I'm not a demographer, so don't quote me on that one.
Well, that is a big part of it. The population as a whole is aging. But also it reflects the fact that among younger people, there's a reluctance to affiliate with broad social institutions, including churches. And so if you have among younger people, fewer people who are identifying with any religious group in the same way that they're more reluctant to identify with political parties or other social institutions, that's going to show up in those numbers as well.
Researching for this conversation, I came upon this phrase culturally Catholic, which is very interesting because the idea is that 45% of Americans have some connection to Catholicism, but only 20.8% call themselves Catholic. And so the rest are people who may or may not feel sort of culturally Catholic, which is not the same thing as being a practicing Catholic. And yet these individuals might be influenced by things the Pope says. What's your sense of that?
I would think there would be some influence there. There's no doubt of the diminished, you know, number of people who are going to church on a regular basis in this country. And I think that that's part of the thing that the Pope is trying to change. Now, whether or not this is going to happen, I think is a very open question. I mean, he's only going to be here for a few days. And, you know, from what I read, there's mixed reports around the world as to whether he has had any effect to now, up to now, on whether or not there's going to be a greater resurgence of renewal within the church membership.
Yeah, it's definitely true that cultural Catholicism is a major phenomenon in the United States, as it is in Latin America and Europe as well, of people who feel in some sense attached to the Catholic Church but are not regularly engaged in religious practice. That's a growing group. It is something that exists outside of Catholicism too. Lots of people, for example, are culturally Jewish without being religiously observant. So there's something of that same phenomenon within Catholicism. What, of course, Pope Francis would like to do is to galvanize some of those people into a much more live and active religious practice. And we'll see what level of success he's able to have with that.
Francis goes out of his way to make the point that he is not a political figure, that he is a religious figure. But he says things that definitely have implications for politics around the world, here in the United States. How problematic is it that he is, on the one hand, a darling of liberals in America because of some of the things that he said about greater acceptance of, you know, same-sex couples or people who are gay and lesbian. On the other hand, he is sort of less popular with liberals, more popular with conservatives when he talks about traditional church positions on things like abortion and birth control.
Well, that's the same that's been going on for a long time. I mean, Cardinal Bernardin in the United States back 25 years ago talked about the whole notion that the life issues are joined together in one type of thing. And so opposition to war is tied in with opposition to abortion. And, I mean, traditionally, the Catholic teaching has always been both of those things. And that's why it's hard to pigeonhole it one way or another, I think.
Right. And in fact, if you ask, is the Catholic Church liberal or is the Catholic Church conservative? The answer to that is yes. That is, the church takes positions that transcend those kinds of secular political categories. In fact, as a Catholic myself, I would be troubled if the church's teaching neatly conformed to the platform of any secular political party. And so there are certainly elements in the teaching of the church and in Pope Francis's own teaching that are going to make American secular conservatives uncomfortable. There are elements that are going to make American secular liberals uncomfortable. And I think the Pope is fine with that. In fact, I think he relishes the point at which he challenges the easy and comfortable presuppositions of people across the political spectrum.
The Pope certainly has made some strong statements against capitalism, or at least using capitalism as a means to earning money at any cost, including the cost of, you know, human suffering.
Oh, that's very true, but it's not original. I mean, some of the statements of Benedict XVI were even stronger, but I mean, this Pope is a much more popular figure. For example, the last encyclical he wrote there. In fact, that's interesting. It's the second encyclical, the first one people have already forgotten about. Because, again, it was written in Vaticanese that nobody reads. This present one, and Laudato Si, has been, read quite a bit and commented upon quite a bit and received quite a bit of publicity. And therefore, I mean, this Pope obviously has a greater cachet with the media and is able, therefore, to make his positions better known. But that position has always been there.
Right. And in fact, this teaching in the church goes all the way back to the late 19th century with the encyclical Rerum Novarum, beginning there and carrying through in a consistent body of teaching where the church has always argued that capitalism had to be tempered with humanity, that capitalism had to be tempered with respect and love for the integrity of the person, that we cannot deify the market in and of itself, that the market has to be subservient to the common good, to the interests of human beings. And I think that Pope Francis certainly puts that in a very forceful and dramatic way. And so the tone is sharper than what we've seen from some of his predecessors. But he's not breaking in any way with traditional Catholic teaching on this, which has never glorified unfettered capitalism.
The Wall Street Journal called Pope Paul VI's encyclical Populorum Progressio, quote, warmed over Marxism, close quote. So you can see this is a
similar
consistent
have been
position,
thrown at this
right?
Pope. Yeah.
Right.
So have we given Pope Francis? Have we assumed that he is making bigger changes than he actually is? He's simply packaging traditional Catholic teachings in a way that people find more palatable.
Well, there are shifts,
or less palatable.
depending on what the issue is and who you are, right? There are differences in emphasis. The church has an incredibly wide and rich body of teaching on a whole host of issues. And so any church teacher, any pope, is going to have to choose which of those things he will lead with in his engagement of the world. This pope has chosen to a significant degree to lead with engaging the world on issues of economic justice and the environment. Previous popes may have chosen different issues with which to lead in their engagement of the surrounding secular world. But that doesn't mean a change in teaching. That doesn't mean that the church somehow now believes something different than she did 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago. But different times call for different points of challenge to prevailing assumptions in the world. And I think this pope sees and deeply feels that there's a need to challenge prevailing assumptions with regard to economic justice.
So what I'm sorry, Charlie, go ahead.
Well, I think that perhaps the inner church area of things, the change that he is trying to bring about is with regard to church structures. There's no doubt that the Roman Catholic Church has been heavily centralized. It often is called a monarchy, with all the power coming from the Pope down. And many of us in the church argue that really should not be the case, but it has developed that way in the last two centuries especially. And as a result, then, there's no doubt that this Pope has talked about decentralizing the church, that he has talked about the need to reform the Roman Curia, the bureaucracy of the Vatican, so that it doesn't tell other people what to do around the world, but it services what the local bishops are trying to do. Now, this is a very significant thing in the long term. It's not going to have any effect tomorrow or next week or next month, but in the long term, it could have tremendous effects. Now, what everybody's waiting for, the Pope has talked about this. He's appointed commissions, but there's been little or no actual structural change. One very interesting thing, which has been shown in his two major documents, is the fact that unlike any previous papal documents, he has quoted what the local bishops have said. In the encyclical on the oncology, there are 20 different references to what the African bishops have said, what the Senegalese bishops have said, what the Asian bishops have said, what the European bishops have said. This is an entirely new way of proceeding. In the past, you never saw that. Everything came from the top down. Now, this, therefore, is a very significant thing. But the reality is that has to put flesh and blood on it in terms of the structures themselves. But there's no doubt that he wants to do something about the over-centralization of the church. And in the long run, that's probably the most significant thing that might happen in this papacy.
Could I add one thing to that?
Yes, but we're going to a break, so hang on to that thought,
sure.
And we'll come back and you'll have all the time you need. We're speaking this hour with Matthew Wilson, who's Associate Professor of Political Science at the Dedman College of Humanities and Sciences at SMU, and Charles Curran, Elizabeth Scurlock University Professor of Human Values at SMU. We're talking about American Catholicism in light of the Pope's visit. If you'd like to jump in on this conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about American Catholicism, and my guests are Charles Curran, who is Elizabeth Scurlock Professor of Human Values at SMU, and Matthew Wilson, Associate Professor of Political Science in the Dedman College at SMU. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Matthew, before the break, Charlie brought up this idea that the Pope is very interested in decentralizing the way that the church is run and organized, perhaps not so surprising for a guy who spent the vast majority of his career on the ground as a priest and then as a bishop in Buenos Aires.
Right. And I think this tendency to take national episcopal conferences more seriously, the tendency to reform Vatican governance and kind of clean up the curia is a very popular initiative. I think it's something that unites American Catholics who would think of themselves as more liberal as well as American Catholics who would think of themselves as more conservative. They'd all like to see Vatican bureaucracy reformed. They'd all like to see more transparency in governance and decision making in Rome. And so I think that's something that American Catholics are very, very broadly united behind. The other thing that I just wanted to pick up on quickly that Charlie had said is I think it is indeed very important that we're seeing more recognition of the voices and views of bishops and cardinals from the developing world because they bring very, very different perspectives from what has been traditionally a pretty Eurocentric view coming out of Rome. But it cuts in a couple of different ways. That is, these leaders from the developing world tend to very much echo the Pope's strong statements on economic justice and climate change and ecology. They also are very, very orthodox in terms of church teaching on sexuality issues, family issues. So taking those voices seriously has a lot of implications in strengthening and sharpening church teaching, but not always in a quote-unquote leftward or rightward direction. It's a complex mix.
All right, let's talk about sexuality and family issues. We can assume that most American Catholic adults are well aware of the church's prescriptions on things like premarital sex, extramarital sex, and birth control. We can also assume that at least the vast majority of American Catholics who are married and in families have availed themselves of artificial methods of birth control because family sizes are considerably smaller than they were a couple of generations ago. Could we argue that it's simply not working for the church to sort of lay down a command about something that affects people's lives for decades and expect people to follow in lockstep?
Well, it's obvious that people are not following it. And there, as you know, there's been a strong number of people in the church, myself included, who have argued for years that we have to change the teaching on artificial contraception. I mean, the very fact that Catholics use artificial contraception in their marriage as much as non-Catholics do in this country, according to all the polls and statistics. So then the question arises, why doesn't the church change its teaching? For example, there's an editorial in the New York Times today asking the Pope to change the teaching on contraception. Well, I think the real reason behind this is that the people in the church are afraid if you change the teaching on contraception, you're going to have to change it on other issues as well. And there is very, very good reason why that could happen, because the basic condemnation that the Catholic Church gives of artificial contraception is you have to look at the purpose of the sexual power. It's procreative and love union aspects. Both have to be present in the same act. But that has been criticized because the moral criterion should be the person. What is good for the person and what is good for the person's relationships. But the minute you bring in that criterion, you're going to have to change on issues like gay marriage, et cetera, and therefore people are very afraid to change on contraception for fear of what will happen if you do.
I would say a couple of things. First of all, it is clear that many American Catholics do not live by the church's teaching on contraception. I would add also, however, that I think a lot of American Catholics fail sometimes to turn the other cheek, and a lot of American Catholics fail to love their enemies. Moral teachings, by their very nature, are hard.
Right.
And their correctness is not measured according to the percentage of people who agree to abide by them, particularly difficult, challenging moral teachings. I think that a big part of the reason that the church doesn't change its teaching on this issue, I mean, certainly there are aspects to what Charlie said that are absolutely right in terms of its implications for other doctrines. But I think that church leaders truly do believe that in the truth of this doctrine about the necessary union of the marital love and procreation in the sexual act. And that manifests itself, among other things, in the teaching on contraception. Also, I think the church is very troubled by the fact that the line between contraception and abortion can become quite blurry with some methods of contraception. And it becomes theologically a real challenge to distinguish between the nature of the moral teaching on one and the nature of the moral teaching on the other. So this is a complex issue. It is one where many American Catholics do not live by the teaching of the church, but it wouldn't be the only one that falls into that category.
I was surprised to read that 88% of American Catholics are supportive of the Pope's sort of public call to extend forgiveness to women who have had abortions. But we should note that this is not new. There is no sin that, right, within the Catholic Church and according to Catholic doctrine, if one is truly penitent, there is no sin that can't be forgiven. And that's always been the case for abortion as much as anything else.
Right. This is not revolutionary at all. I mean, it says more about the perceptions of people who find this to be a revolutionary teaching than it does about the church or the teaching itself. Of course, sin can be forgiven of any sort, however grave, if there's genuine repentance. And the church has never taught otherwise. The church has never said that abortion is an unforgivable sin. So Pope Francis is merely echoing what I think would be widely accepted in Catholic moral theology.
It's a little bit more complex than that, but I think you're basically right, Matt, that the press, whatever it was there 2 weeks ago, just played this up as a big, huge thing. Well, it wasn't big, it wasn't huge, and it wasn't new. But the complexity is this, that in addition to the forgiveness of sin, the Roman Catholic Church law also says there's an excommunication for anybody who has an abortion. And therefore, everybody could forgive the sin. Any priest could forgive the sin, but they couldn't forgive the excommunication, the legal thing attached to it. But the reality was, in the United States, the power to forgive the excommunication was given to every bishop. Every bishop gave it to every priest in the United States. The second aspect of it was that no one incurred the excommunication and they didn't know it existed. 99% of the people never knew there was an excommunication connected with it. So, I mean, this in reality, in practice, nothing has really changed. But again, it's a sign of how the media is bending over backward to say that the Pope is doing all these new things. Well, it wasn't new at all.
How political is the climate within American Catholic parishes? How often does sort of day-to-day political business come into the content of a homily in the U.S.?
Very rarely, in my experience. I would say that going to Catholic Mass more or less weekly through my entire life, I could count on the fingers of one hand the number of homilies that I would classify is in any way political. And this goes back a long time in the history of the American Catholic Church. Parish priests have been long reluctant to get involved directly in any sort of partisan political affairs. I mean, the church has teaching on issues that have political implications, but compared to a lot of other religious traditions in the United States, the American parish is fairly apolitical.
Does Francis want to change that?
I don't think he wants to see the church engaged in partisan politics. I think he would like for priests to have a sharp focus on issues of moral importance that may have political implications, but I don't think he wants to see the church wading into partisan politics.
I would agree, but I think he certainly does want the homilies in the church to speak more about the needs of the poor, about the concern of the poor, about the dangers of the existing unregulated capitalistic system, and so forth. But then he would be the first one, as he did his encyclical, to say, but we don't have an answer for all of this, but we got to recognize it's a problem and there are certain principles that have to be followed. And in many places, those principles aren't being followed.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. First, we have Andre on the line in Richardson. Hello, Andre.
Hello. My question deals with the U.S. administration and papal relations. I was wondering if the speakers could assess just how those have gone and how this one is shaping up in light of there's been reports that those who are going to greet the Pope at the White House have some notably contrarian views to Orthodox teaching. And I've heard varying reports on how the Vatican has responded to that. So if the commenters could just respond on that.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I'm not too sure whether the comment from the caller, Andrew, is more dealing with the church-state relations, which I thought it was in the beginning. But as it came about, it was just more differences of people within the church kinds of things. And again, that goes back to what we said before. There are certainly divisions within the Catholic Church in this country. I mean, that part of this whole problem is that there is a twofold aspect that the Pope carries with him. The one, he's the head of the Roman Catholic Church. The other is he's the head of a state, a Vatican State. I mean, if the Pope weren't the head of Vatican State, the President of the United States would have a very difficult time of meeting him at the airport because of the separation of church and state. And I think they would also have a difficult time of inviting him to speak before Congress. Now, this cuts both ways, because sometimes the Pope is not able to speak out in a religious way because he has to deal with the state. I mean, put it this way. Here the Pope is right now in a socialist state, communist state, and the Vatican has had relationships with that communist state all along, even though the United States has not done so. Then the Pope goes 90 miles and comes to the United States, and he has to deal with an entirely different form of government. Interestingly enough, he didn't totally condemn the Castros, and he isn't going to totally condemn this country. And now some people in the church would say maybe trying to do both has its problems and might limit the prophetic voice of the church at times. I mean, this is a deeper issue that certainly deserves a lot of consideration.
I would say in terms of relationships between the current presidential administration and the Catholic Church, it's been a very rocky road for the Obama administration and the American Catholic Church. In fact, a whole host of Catholic institutions are currently suing the Obama administration over the contraception and abortifacient mandate within Obamacare. So, I mean, there's pending litigation between Catholic Church entities and the presidential administration right now. I doubt the Pope will speak publicly about that. It would be interesting to know if he tried to say something in private to President Obama with regard to that. But I think what the caller was referencing is there have been a lot of media reports that some of the people that President Obama has invited to greet the Pope include people who are obvious and public dissenters from major elements of church teaching, including some transgender activist, including one of the nuns on the bus who opposed the American Catholic Bishop's position on the health care reform bill and several others. So some people have seen that as in poor taste and intentionally and needlessly provocative. That's been the criticism. But, you know, President Obama is trying to walk a fine line between balancing the concerns of his liberal support base with, you know, also not gratuitously offending the Pope. And people can make their own judgments as to whether he's struck the right balance there.
And the Pope himself has chosen to meet with a lot of people who would seem to qualify for his disdain. I mean, he's met all over the world with people who are in prison in the United States. Among the people that he's going to meet with who are currently incarcerated is a woman who's accused of murdering her 8-month-old baby and blaming the murder on her 5-year-old. Now, she's not been convicted. She's pending trial. But this is not someone who is being held on a marijuana charge. This is someone who, if guilty, everyone would condemn the crime.
And who, if guilty, could conceivably face the death penalty, at least in many jurisdictions in the United States, which I suspect is, in fact, part of the point, right? Because the Pope is very much an opponent of the death penalty. And I think, just to back up the way you framed the question, I think the Pope would encourage us to say that there is really no one who has earned his disdain, that there are people who merit his disagreement. There are people whose attitudes and behaviors merit strong and unequivocal condemnation. but they're still human beings created in the image and likeness of God. And I think that is the point that he wants very powerfully to communicate in meeting with these people who would be, in some ways, legitimately outcast at the margins of society.
I mean, I think that fits so well with his whole emphasis on mercy and forgiveness, and that's totally a part of that picture. I mean, the other interesting thing about this papal visit is there are many more visits to poor people. I mean, who else addresses the Congress of the United States at 10 o'clock in the morning and then goes down to have lunch with poor people with Catholic Charities in St. Patrick's Church in Washington? This is symbolic in so many ways of saying that, yes, you have to deal with the power and the authorities, but you also have to be with the poor people.
800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Francisco in Dallas. Hi, Francisco.
Hi there. I'd just like to share a comment. I'm gay and Catholic. And at one point in my life, I was ashamed to say I was gay. And at another point in my life when I was openly gay, I was ashamed to say I was Catholic. But ever since Francis has sort of, I felt, changed the sort of culture of the church and making it more welcoming to gay people. I could have a weekend like I did this weekend where in Dallas we celebrated gay pride. So I went to church at Holy Trinity Catholic Church and then went to the gay pride. And I'm not saying that we should expect, the Pope to be at gay pride marches, but I feel like the job of a Pope is to call people to God, all people. And he's certainly done a marvelous job of that for people like me.
Thank you so much for your call, Francisco. We're going to take a quick break now. We can get a comment from our guests after we do that. We're speaking this hour about American Catholicism in light of the Pope's visit, which begins tomorrow. Charles Curran is here. He's Elizabeth Scurlock University Professor of Human Values at SMU. My other guest is Matthew Wilson, Associate Professor of Political Science in the Dedman College of Humanities and Sciences at SMU. You can join us at 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the state of American Catholicism on the eve of the first visit by Pope Francis to the United States. If you'd like to join our conversation with Charles Curran and Matthew Wilson, both of SMU, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Before the break, we heard from Francisco, who says he's gay and Catholic and has felt welcome at least at one parish that he worships at in Dallas.
I mean, one of the things that this brings up is the real difficulty and the real challenge that the church faces between how to simultaneously be welcoming and be open and to invite anyone to participate in dialogue with the church and to encounter God in the setting of the church without affirming whatever behavior those people might be engaged in, any of us. I mean, all of us are sinners in one way or another. And so then, therefore, one of the challenges for Pope Francis, as he talks about more openness and inclusion, is to balance that with not wanting to confuse the church's teaching on kind of core moral issues in which some people may be in disagreement. So, the classic formulation is love the sinner, hate the sin. That's easier to say very often than it is to live out in practice.
I think there's some truth to that, Matt. Now, I come at it from the other side. I think the Catholic Church should change its teaching with regard to sexuality and also with regard to gay relationships. And I think in the long run, that probably people are going to be disappointed with Pope Francis because he's not going to do that. Francis has said very openly that I'm a child of the church, a son of the church, and I agree with all these teachings. And so I frankly do worry that down the line people are going to become much more frustrated when they realize he isn't going to change teachings. And I think the gay is a good example of it. We mentioned before, or I mentioned, that I think one of the reasons why they refuse to change the teaching on contraception is the fear that this will open up to other things. And you're never going to change your teaching on gay relationships until you change on contraception. And I'm afraid that just isn't going to happen.
Centuries ago, when if you were a Christian, the Catholic Church was pretty much the only game in town, there were major disagreements about the right way to be a Christian. And what happened was people broke off and formed Protestantism. Today, people who disagree with the Catholic Church, who were raised in the church, might simply choose another church. What's been interesting about the research that I've read is that there are a number of Catholics who have left the church but can imagine themselves going back. Are these holdouts waiting for Pope Francis or his successor to sort of change the rules that they dislike? Or is there something else that has sort of pulled them out of the Catholic Church and pushed them toward a Protestant church or another belief system?
Well, of course, I mean, there are a myriad different individual
stories.
It's
hard to
generalize. Right,
yeah.
About why people take the religious trajectory that they do. I think very often people would say that they could be part of what in their mind is some sort of idealized version of the Catholic Church. There are, by the way, schismatics on the other side, too, the intensely traditionalist folks who, when the church abandoned the Latin Mass. Well, Opus Dei is completely in faithful communion with the church. I'm talking about like Society of St. Pius X and some of these other folks who left the Catholic Church when they said the Catholic Church abandoned traditional teaching in Vatican II and things like that. And so they say essentially the same thing. If the church accepted our view of the world, we could come back. But what they're saying then is they want to be in communion with a church as they imagine it, not the church as it is. But I am generalizing here because, as we say, there's so many different individual reasons why a person might go on the particular religious or spiritual path that they do.
But I think you brought up, Chris, the reality of one of the earlier Pew studies showed that one out of three Roman Catholics has left the church in the United States in the last, whatever it was, 20 years. And the amazing figure that the second largest, denomination in the United States is ex-Catholics. That one out of 10 people in the United States identifies as a former Catholic. Now, that's a huge problem that the Catholic Church has to face. And unfortunately, I don't think it has been willing to recognize that, stare it in the face and say, what are we going to do about it? And I do think that a part of this is the sexual teachings. And the problem there was, you see, that they were so specific with such great certitude, whereas on the whole social teaching, you weren't that certain and you weren't that specific. You didn't say that this particular act is right or wrong kind of thing. So as a result, then, I think that we have to squarely face up to this thing that we up to now have been unwilling to face.
Let's talk about the role of women. Pope Francis has sort of extended this idea that women should play a greater role in the church. He has not gone anywhere near the idea that women might enter the priesthood or that even that married men could be allowed to become ordained if they haven't been like previously ordained. It's complicated. But basically, he's not really talking about letting married priests or women be priests. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely correct.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I don't – and one should be careful about conflating those two issues because they're two different kinds of issues. Right. That is, the question of married priests is a prudential judgment question of church discipline. That is, in – previous eras, there were married priests in the early history of the church. The church recognizes the validity of the sacramental ordination of, for example, married Eastern Orthodox priests and things like that. Women priests is a different can of worms. That would entail the church redefining the core of how it has understood the sacrament of ordination. And so one could imagine a scenario in which the church allowed priests to be married. allowing women priests is a much more radical step than that. And too often I think those two questions get conflated when they're different kinds of choices for the church.
They're different in the sense that the ordination of married men is just everybody admits is a human law of the church, whereas the official church teaching is it's a divine law about the ordination of women. Now, I totally disagree with that. It seems to me it's not a divine law. It's just a socially cultural norm that was true of everybody in society a certain time. What we tend to forget so often is how much the church has changed over the years in so many, many different areas. And probably the worst one we had was slavery, that the church could not change its teaching on slavery for 19 centuries is a tough problem for us to deal with. But I really think today that the hardest thing for anybody in the church is for women. That I taught at Catholic University in Washington for 20-plus years. I had women doctoral students, every one of whom went through a crisis. Practically everyone went through a crisis of faith between what they were learning theologically and what they were experiencing practically. And that this question of educated women is, I think, going to be a real problem for the church. And you see, in a sense, too, in the United States, we have a highly educated, theologically educated number of women. They never had that in Europe up until maybe 3 or 4 years ago. So that the church authorities in Italy or even in South America never ran into an educated, theologically educated woman. No experience of this. Now, and as I say, I think the reason this is such a huge problem is, talking about Francesco's problem earlier, if you're a gay and Catholic, you can make up your decision and say, I'm a Catholic and I go to Eucharist every Sunday and fully participate. No one knows the difference. And I know a lot of gay Catholics who are totally committed, who go to church every Sunday and are totally committed. Nobody says anything. But see, you can solve those problems in the form of conscience. You can't solve the woman's issue in the form of conscience. You've got to change church structures, and they're not going to be changed very soon. And that's why I think the role that I feel that the people who are suffering the most in the church today are women in the church, as they're looking for this kind of change, and it's not going to come.
Well, I would say that women are really the backbone of parish life in the American church. That is, women on average have higher levels of church attendance than men. Women have higher levels of reported, aspects of spiritual life, frequency of prayer, devotional activity, those sorts of things. Women are very, very active in running a lot of the day-to-day business of American Catholic parishes. So their role is essential. And I think that leaving aside the question of clerical ordination, Pope Francis has really stressed the desire to get women much more involved in positions of lay leadership and to be much more active participants in theological discussions in Rome, reflecting, as I think Charlie quite rightly said, the fact that there are a lot of women with deep levels of theological education, particularly from the United States, but increasingly elsewhere in the world, too.
One other thing that unites, let's call them liberal and conservative American Catholics, is the desire for an end to any kind of danger of sexual abuse of children within the church, and certainly an end to any cover-ups of those events that have happened in the past. Do you imagine that Pope Francis will address this in a very explicit manner when he's here, and what might he say in the United States that he hasn't said elsewhere about this problem?
Well, I doubt if he'll say anything in the United States he has not said elsewhere. I mean, you don't expect something new to be done on a trip to a country. It's interesting. When Pope Benedict XVI was here, he did meet with victims of abuse. They have not publicized this with regard to the present visit, but I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if they did that. Now, in the meantime, the Pope has appointed this commission to look into this matter, to come up with norms for the whole world, et cetera. Again, it's one of those things we haven't seen the product of the commission yet, but he obviously knows the problem and I think wants to do something about it. But what will happen exactly, we don't know yet.
Yeah, this is an area in which just day-to-day life in Catholic parishes around the world has changed dramatically over the last decade or so in response to this issue. That is, the level of attention that's given to, you know, background screenings of adults who work with youth, and the at least on a rhetorical level, the attention that's given to the need to protect youth from anybody who might be a predator or anything like that is something that you just never heard talked about in the church 20, 30 years ago. So, I mean, there is unquestionably a different tone about these issues of clerical abuse. And, you know, the various popes have apologized abjectly and profusely for this horrific stain on the church many times. There's not a lot that Pope Francis could say beyond that, beyond what's already been said in terms of, you know, apologizing for past misdeeds. Going forward, the question is institutionally, how does this commission that he has appointed change the way or make recommendations for the way that bishops on the ground, when they receive allegations that some sort of impropriety has taken place, what protocols do they use to deal with that? And you know, that's really on a practical level where the rubber hits the road in terms of change.
There have been some Americans in Congress, the Pope is set to address Congress this week, who have said, I'm not especially interested in hearing this because despite agreeing with these positions, I disagree with these positions, and therefore I don't feel the need to, you know, I don't want to attend. Is that something, is it still politically too dangerous for any American political leader to do something that might offend Catholic constituents?
Well, I think most politicians have their finger in the air all the time, and they don't want to offend too many people. But they and obviously Catholics are a great number of people, and you want to think twice about if you're going to offend them. And so I think that's always a part of political consciousness. Now, Matt's the political scientist. I'm not. Let him take that question from there.
I mean, I think it would be regarded as extraordinarily bad form to snub the Holy Father, the Pope visiting the United States, an extraordinarily popular Pope visiting the United States, and to say that I won't even listen to what he has to say, I think would come across very, very badly, whether we're talking about a conservative member of Congress or a liberal member of Congress, because there's something in the Pope's teaching and the Church's teaching for all of them to disagree with, that they can find something that is objectionable. But I think that he will receive a respectful hearing. And I would say that in the same way that many conservatives have urged liberals and liberal Catholics for a long time not to adopt cafeteria Catholicism, that is, not pick and choose the things that you agree with and ignore the rest, now the tables are turned a little bit. And I think American conservative Catholics have to heed their own advice and say, listen even to those teachings that make you uncomfortable. And I think we'll see that.
Matthew Wilson is Associate Professor of Political Science in the Dedman College at SMU. Charles Curran is Elizabeth Scurlock University Professor of Human Values at SMU. Guys, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be here.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is Associate Producer with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. And our Executive Producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.